Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
The next order of business, if it pleases your highness, is the issue of continued vandalism of the castle's east wall.
More graffiti? Well, what does it say this time?
The details are not important, your majesty, but suffice to say that the work criticized certain royal policies as well as the royal beard.
The royal beard? Well, I never. What are we doing to combat the problem? We solved the west wall graffiti issue.
Yes, my lord, but we're working to implement a constant guard presence, anti-vandalism spikes, and erratic paint scheme.
Alright, well, it worked before, it'll work this time. Case closed.
Well, yes, my lord, but these solutions merely prevent the physical vandalism of a particular stretch of the wall at any given time. This is but a tame or a benign problem, you know? The overall issue of vandalism with the kingdom, it's a wicked problem.
A wicked problem? Sorcery! Fetch the witch hunter general!
No, my lord. Not sorcery, not pervasiveness, complexity. We're talking about a public policy issue here, one with roots in economics, law, religion, and other areas. We can't simply pull up the weed because the roots are tangled throughout the soil. And indeed, treating one underlying cause is likely to disrupt other areas of royal interest, alienate supporters, or force us to face unflattering facts about ourselves.
The royal beard is above reproach.
Certainly, my lord, certainly. A finer beard has never been grown in God's creation. No question there. But what is in question is the very nature of the problem. Is it the mere physical act of vandalism? Is it the perception of the crown? Poverty? A lack of religion or education? This is a wicked problem.
A wicked problem, you say?
Yes, my lord. The wickedest. By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And my name is Christian Sager. And as you can guess from our little audio play at the beginning there, we are talking today about wicked problems.
Yeah, this is a fascinating sort of overview topic and I wasn't really familiar with this terminology.
Yeah, I wasn't either. I actually stumbled across this a couple days ago. One of the resources that we're going to talk about today about Maine's sort of political science approach to wicked problems popped up on my radar, and I read that and I thought, wow, this is a really interesting way for us to sort of approach science for the show. And it's a way that we don't usually talk about science, right? Like, science podcasts usually have like such a reverence for the institution of science.
Science is the great problem solver. It's the thing upon which we have built everything we hold dear. It is it is humanity's backbone in a way.
In a lot of ways, science is treated in the same way as religion is by some people, right? Like, I know plenty of people who aren't religious, but they turn to science as having the answers, and it's definitive for them, right? And this is a really interesting way to approach that, because it gets into the deeper complexities of using science as a way to solve the world's problems.
Yeah, and it gets into, it basically deals with our inability, and certainly our difficulties with tackling complex problems, complex issues, throughout our culture.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to try to approach, we're going to tell you what a wicked problem is, first of all, but the way that we're going to try to approach it here is sort of on this scale. There are macro wicked problems, which we're going to talk about, which are sort of like our large scale societal ills, I guess. And then we're going to talk about it in relation to science and the science community. And then we're going to bring it down to the human level and talk about it, in the way that it's most applied in theory, which is in the workplace. And it's the model of wicked problems is used, basically as like a management technique.
And we should probably also take a moment to discuss, its ties to, Boston area dialect, right?
Yeah. So, this is worth mentioning, and we played around with a little bit of the audio play. I'm from New England originally, most people probably don't notice that because I tried not to affect my accent on the air. But whenever the word wicked is thrown into something, it might seep out a little bit here or there. So you might hear me losing some R's here or there, or changing the way I pronounce things as we're going through. I'm going to try to hold it together.
Well, I admit that when I was reading the material about this and reading some of the papers, I would come to the phrase wicked problems.
Yeah.
And I would often hear it spoken in my head in the voice of Julianne Moore's character on 30 Rock, where she played the Bostonian divorcee.
Yeah, she did a great job with that. Yeah, it's either Julianne Moore or like Mark Wahlberg in The Departed, doing his best Dorchester accent. Yeah. Okay, so wicked problem. What is it? You're probably wondering, what the heck are we talking about? We sort of introduced you to the basic idea throughout that little play that we enacted. But here's the breakdown. A wicked problem is a social or cultural problem that's difficult to solve because of incomplete or contradictory knowledge. And usually the number of people that are involved in the interconnected nature of this problem is part of other problems, right? So they're all connected. And often it's just written off as too cumbersome to be something to bother with. So this is going to seem familiar to all of you, as especially citizens of the United States, as we are in the middle of a crazy presidential cycle. And all of these things are coming up and are frequently being talked about with, in my opinion, very little concrete answers, because they're wicked problems, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a standard aspect of politics. Nobody's getting up there and stumping and campaigning and saying, on the topic of poverty, this is a complex issue and we probably will not be able to solve it.
Exactly.
We're going to throw our best minds at it, but every time we try and fix it, we're probably going to change the problem. Nobody's saying that. People are saying, I have a plan. Or I'm going to throw some really, classy people at it and fix it. Nobody is campaigning on a platform of wicked problems.
But I think like the more mature approach, and probably for some candidates, maybe once they're in office, the approach is, hey, look, like these are problems that are so big, we will never solve them, right?
Yeah.
But we can, if we can sort of understand them on a larger level like that and use that framework, then we can approach them in a different way that's healthier and maybe can make them better. Maybe not solve them, but make them better. So we're talking about poverty, sustainability, equality, health, wellness, racism, our failing education systems, terrorism, you name it, all that stuff falls under sort of the rubric of wicked problems.
Yeah, right? Or multi-headed snake monsters in the swamp.
Yeah,
to go
exactly.
back to our Hydra episode, because even the Hydra, of course, the idea being that you every time you chop off a head, two or more grow in its place. Even Hercules,
mm-hmm.
son of a god, took on this task, and the best he could do was limit it to one undying head and just sort of hide that head under a rock, which is perhaps a telling metaphor for like even the best attempts to tackle a wicked problem. All you can really do is like clear cut and bury and hope that people forget that this was a problem, I guess.
I think the Hydra metaphor is going to work well throughout this. As, I'm not quite sure what order we're going to release these in. But, yeah, so we also talked this week about Hydras on a different episode. And Hydras are a great example for it because you can't solve the Hydra problem, right? You at least the mythic one.
Yeah.
You cut off one head, two more heads grow to replace it, right? And so I think maybe like the angle of wicked problems is knowing what the two heads are that are going to grow to replace it.
Yeah, or trying to figure it out, or certainly just being conscious of the fact that complex problems are complex.
Yeah.
That many of these issues that are not going to be easily tackled, and you're not going to be able to solve them with a quick application of this policy or that policy. That's why they are wicked.
And not to mention, you know, the theoretical applications within the workplace. You know, I'm assuming most of you out there listening have jobs or have had a job and know the frustrations that go along with that. And really, you can use the wicked problem model at that level, too. And I find that it gives like a little bit of a sense of freedom and relief when you think about it that way, the frustration of employment issues.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to remember that the wicked problem is in contrast to a tame or benign problem. The tame or benign problem is often just a simple mathematical problem, you know, like what's 2 + 2? Well, there's an answer to that, and it's 4. An engineering problem. How do we build this thing so that it doesn't collapse? There's an answer. It can be achieved. You have you know what the mission is when you go in to try and solve it, mm-hmm. and then you solve it. We love questions like that. And it's easy to look to wicked problems and try to solve them like that, to want them to be solved like that. I've read, you know, that's one of the reasons that the zombie motif is so popular, the zombie apocalypse, because
in
the zombie apocalypse, all problems become tame or benign.
Mm.
The zombie comes, what do? You shoot it in the head.
Yeah,
you
right.
cut its head off, you kill it.
Right, those are relatively easy to solve problems, and it makes the relevance of the wicked problems go away, right?
Yeah, like, you know, your better zombie fiction has wicked problems in it as well, I feel.
Sure.
Like you look at like Walking Dead, they're attempting to graft in wicked problems into the narrative. But at heart, at the very sort of video game or Dawn of the Dead level, it's all about tame, benign problems.
I was talking to a friend about this yesterday as I was researching it and saying, like, this is pretty fascinating stuff. You ever heard of this? And he hadn't. But he said, he maybe like kind of broadened the scale of it, but he hadn't looked at the research. He said, well, life's a wicked problem, isn't it?
And yeah.
Like, when you come down to it, the human body is a wicked problem, because no matter what we do to the human body, no matter how well we exercise, no matter what we eat that's healthy, something's always going to pop up that we can't control, right?
Yeah, I mean, the self, the mind is a wicked problem. Yeah. I think back to, you know, the old Sound of Music track, how do you solve a problem like Maria?
Yeah.
It's kind of a goofy reference point, but how do you solve a problem like Maria? How do you solve a problem like the individual, like the self? Like, that is a complex situation. It's not just an A plus B equals C equation going on there. We spend our whole lives trying to solve this unsolvable problem.
Yeah, and so the interesting thing about the wicked problem, I guess, paradigm, or as Slavoj Žižek says, paradigma, is that, you know, that's the key to it, is learning to approach it that way and to say, okay, well, that's unsolvable, right? That's not a thing that can be fixed by its very nature. But there's ways to mitigate it. There's ways to approach it differently. And having that very position puts you in a better position, I guess, to approach it, right? So one major proposal that keeps coming up, and in fact, if you Google wicked problems, one of the first things that comes up is a website for a book called Wicked Problems, that's by a design, educational facility in Austin, Texas. And, the whole book's available for free, actually. You can read it online on the web, or you can buy it in print. But they basically say, look, like, the way to approach this is through strategic design, and it's a combination of using empathy, abductive reasoning, and rapid prototyping. Those are the ways that they sort of think about, you know, let's approach these. First of all, acknowledge that they're a wicked problem, but then you approach it afterwards. And so, you know, just as a reminder, because I had to remind myself, abductive reasoning is it's the opposite of deductive logic, right? Where there's a premise that leads to a conclusion with a solution, right? There's
right.
Two premises lead to a conclusion. Instead, abductive is that the premise doesn't guarantee any solution. In fact, you have to work from inference, and it's the most simple solution that's inferred that usually leads to some kind of, not a solution in this case, betterment, I guess.
Well, that makes sense in terms of what we're talking about here, because one of the big problems is just even defining what the problem is. You know, you look at something like poverty.
Yeah.
Someone says, hey, we have a problem. There's poverty. And you say, well, what is the problem? Is it that people are poor because of the job situation? Is it more cultural? Does it have to do with our laws? Does it have to do with enforcement of said laws? You know, there's so many variables.
You try to solve one of those things, like try to solve the laws, and maybe it makes another thing worse, right? Like, I'm trying to think of an example, but I keep coming back to like the interconnectedness of, hunger and poverty.
Yeah.
And then like I saw a really good, in one of the articles about wicked problems, it was a really good example of why poverty is such a wicked problem. Like we think of it like, oh, we'll solve that. We've got this problem of poverty connected to people being hungry, but at the same time, we've got a problem of obesity in our society as well. And how are those things connected? You know?
Yeah. I've been thinking about this food thing a lot recently because I'm currently watching Michael Pollan's latest documentary series on, it's on Netflix, and it has to do with cooking and where cooking comes from, and then how the industrialization of food preparation has changed everything. So you see this situation where like one side is trying to make things easier, trying to correct problems, but that ends up creating other problems as well.
Yeah. See, so it's actually really interesting how easily this can be applied. I go back to when I was in grad school, I had a professor who basically referred to stuff like this as like the model fits type analysis, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got this model and you put it on top of something and you're like, does it fit? Okay. But then you've got to go beyond that and sort of synthesize the information, you know, what you've learned from it and analyze and go further. But let's start at the beginning. So
where
did this idea come from? Like, or the origin of wicked problems, right? Like we've certainly had them forever, but,
right.
But
in terms of thinking about them.
Exactly.
Marcus,
yeah.
Well, the, origination of the term is generally attributed to a pair of Berkeley professors in the 1970s. Horst W.J. Riddle, professor of the science of design at the University of California, Berkeley, and Melvin M. Weber, professor of city planning, Berkeley. And then occasionally you see people giving credit to philosopher and system scientist C. West Churchman, largely for popularizing or modernizing it. But basically it comes down to Riddle and Weber. In particular, Riddle and Weber really dove into the topic in their 1973 paper, Dilemmas in a General Theory of Planning, published in Policy Sciences.
Yeah, for this episode, I went through and read that piece.
Yeah, me too.
And there were certainly many things that were relevant to the discussion we're going to have today, but it was so grounded in the American politics of the early 70s that there was a lot of stuff that was like, whoa, okay. But it was interesting too, right? To be able to look back at it.
Well, it kind of gets down to one of the things that we'll discuss that they point out about wicked problems is that every wicked problem is different.
Yeah.
To the point that if you're talking about wicked problems, like just in the shadow of a particular area, if you're talking about wicked problems generally, but really in the back of their mind you're thinking about a specific wicked problem, that colors your definition of what a wicked problem is. Now, I do want to read part of a quote here from them where they really get into the whole idea of why they choose the word wicked. You know, tends to inspire
not because they're
ideas
from Boston
of evil, or Bostonian inflection. They said that they referred to the problems as wicked, quote, not because these properties are themselves ethically deplorable. We use the term wicked in a meaning akin to that of malignant. in contrast to benign, or vicious like a circle, or tricky like a leprechaun.
I love that we're able to always bring back monsters into it.
Yeah, I guess a leprechaun is
more of a fairy.
It's a fairy folk with,
yeah.
It's an unnatural creature, so I think it counts. And they brought it up, not us.
That's true.
Says that, or tricky like a leprechaun, or aggressive like a lion, in contrast to, a lamb.
Yeah.
We do not mean to personify these properties of social systems by implying malicious intent, but then you may agree that it becomes morally objectionable for the planner to treat a wicked problem as though it were a tame one, or to tame a wicked problem prematurely, or to refuse to recognize the inherent wickedness of social problems.
And so that right there, that last bit is what I think gets to the heart of what maybe the connection is today, is the refusal to recognize what this is, right? Mm-hmm. For what it is. And that brings us back to that political analogy of everything that's going on right now. Now, whatever candidate you support or whatever candidate you don't support, all of them are up there. That's the inherent nature of the political system, right? When you're running for office, you pretend like you have all the answers.
Yeah.
And all of them are basically running on a platform where they're like, oh, that problem, I have the answer to that.
Yeah.
That problem, I have the answer to that.
Vote for me. I'm anti-Hydra. Elect me.
Yeah.
And I have, don't worry, I have a plan. I'm going to bring some very classy people to exterminate that Hydra.
And it's worse than that, right? Like, you can't, oh, man, how refreshing would it be to have a candidate come up and just be like, well, look, like, the problems that we're facing are so chaotic and so complex that we as human beings are just not equipped to be able to solve all of them.
Well, there's your problem. That doesn't sound like a politician.
Exactly.
That doesn't sound like somebody that gets elected.
It's like some kind of philosopher or something.
Yeah.
And we just shove that off in a corner and mm-hmm. say, well, that's not authoritative enough for what we need.
Yeah. Actual contemplation of the wicked problems either comes after you're elected mm-hmm. or it falls to the people who are charged with fixing things by the elected individual.
Yeah, that's absolutely mm-hmm. true. And the very idea that you can't formulate a definition of what a wicked problem is actually part of what Riddle and Weber came up with as their 10 characteristics. So the bulk of their article was these characteristics that they lay down, and they basically say, look, these are not criteria tests to determine what the wickedness is, but they're insights to help you to decide if the problem you're facing is wicked. So let's go through these briefly. And I'll note, for those of you out there counting, there's actually 11 here in our list. And that's because Riddle and Weber, I keep wanting to call him Horst because that's his first name.
Mm-hmm.
Riddle and Weber came up with 10, but then over the years, as people have written more about this and applied it to various things, they've come up with their own. And so they're basically the same, but I tried to sort of merge them together here for the purpose of the podcast. So I'll start with the first one, which is that wicked problems have no definitive formulation. They are all different, and they can't contribute to solving one another in any complete way. You can't write a well-defined statement of these problems. And this is a direct quote from the article by Riddle and Weber. The process of formulating the problem and of conceiving a solution are identical, since every specification of the problem is a specification of the direction in which a treatment is considered.
Yeah, I think one example that comes to mind here is the war on drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, drug epidemic is a problem, and then it falls to, well, then how do you define the problem and then go after it? If you,
right.
you end up approaching it from a purely, law enforcement.
Right, when you brand it as a war.
Yeah,
right.
Then you have chosen the direction, and, and then
it's easy for us to look back now, look back at the 80s now and go, oh, why did we brand it as a war on drugs, mm-hmm. right? But at the time, it seemed like a solution to a problem to them.
Yeah. I mean, hindsight's 20/20 on that. But mm-hmm. then once you've employed that strategy, you have changed the problems we'll discuss. So number two, wicked problems involve many stakeholders, all of whom have different ideas about what the problem is and what its causes are. This again, think mm-hmm. of any portion of the world where there's a lot of conflict. Like my mind instantly goes to, at least a couple of different corners of the Middle East. I think of, Israel and Palestine. I think of the current situation in Syria. You have different stakeholders that are involved, at different levels who want different things out of this, but they want them in the name of solving the amorphous problem here.
Totally. And at the micro level, I think we're all familiar with, being in a kind of work situation or involved in any organization. Maybe it's not work. Maybe it's your your housing organization that governs the apartment complex you're in. But you have all these different stakeholders. Everybody's got their own subjective position on these things, right? And they all have different goals too. So that ultimately, even just recognizing that goes a long way towards making things a little bit better. All right, this is number three. It might be impossible to measure any kind of success with a wicked problem given their interconnectedness. The search for solutions will never stop.
And this is a very Hydra portion of the argument here. Because, yeah, any time you actually try and solve a complex problem, yeah, to what extent is your solution creating new problems?
Yeah.
And then not addressing other areas that are all a part of the same issue. So, for instance, poverty. If you were just trying to solve the problem, the wicked problem of poverty by looking at jobs.
Yeah.
Like that's going to help some people.
Sure.
But is it going to help everyone? Is it going to erase poverty? No.
Okay, the fourth one. There are no true or false solutions to wicked problems, only good or bad. It's all subjective, right?
Yeah.
And everyone's judgments will differ, and the solutions can only be described as in that good-bad paradigm, or, and this is from the Riddle and Weber thing, but what's probably better to describe it as is better or worse, right?
Okay.
Things got better or things got worse, not they're good now, they're bad now.
Yeah, like I think back to the war on drugs. Like you can imagine someone saying, hey, we applied this solution to the wicked problem. And then someone says, well, you put a lot of these people had drugs and they're in prison now. They're off the streets. That's good.
Right. Yeah.
And then someone might say, well, it also means that our prison population is extremely overloaded with these low level offenders. That's bad.
And they say that's bad.
Yeah.
Right. And the two things are like, it's like a scale. It's like this like situation where you've got all these different scales that are attached to one another. And anytime you move one little thing, everything shifts a little bit.
Yeah. It's like seating on an airplane. It's like, all right, they moved their chair back. That's bad. I moved mine back. That's good. But now the person behind me is uncomfortable. And now, oh, the person beside me, everything gets out of whack and everybody's miserable and there's nothing you can do about it.
The domino effect of misery.
Yeah. All right. Number five, there's no template to follow when tackling a wicked problem. There's no way to determine right away if a solution is working. So, this gets into just the problem of, this is where we come back to the example you mentioned earlier where they mentioned rapid prototyping, which I guess would work in with certain types of wicked problems, but certainly larger issues out there. Like how do you rapid prototype towards, you know, dealing with crime or dealing with poverty or dealing with hunger or any number of wicked problems that pop up.
It's especially on that scale. It's especially difficult. We'll talk a little bit more about, I think, what they meant by rapid prototyping, but it's essentially, the gist is that like, rather than come up with one solution to approach a problem with and then see if that works. And then if it doesn't, then come up with another solution and keep trying them over and over again. They recommend coming up with multiple solutions and trying them all at once.
Okay.
But you know, there's problems with that too.
So not rapid in succession, but just
I believe that
more like scatter shot.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the shotgun.
Okay. Shotgun prototyping.
Boomstick method.
Boomstick prototyping. I like that.
Okay. Number six is there's always more than one explanation for a wicked problem.
Ah.
And you can see that inherent in the examples that we've just mentioned as well.
Yeah. Number seven, every wicked problem is a symptom of another wicked problem, and there's no single root cause.
Yeah, so back to the interconnectedness and the Hydra nature of it, right? And this one I think is one of the most important of their 10 characteristics here, specifically for us here at Stuff to Blow Your Mind. They say there's no way to scientifically test wicked problem strategies because they're all human inventions. They are outside of nature, right? So when we're thinking about all of these problems, like let's go back to the Hydra, right? Like the Hydra is a natural being that we are learning to understand by looking at through the
methodology. You're talking about the biological creature.
The biological Hydra. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And we now understand how its mouth opens because we looked very closely at it with a light microscope. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But poverty is a human invention. And so how do we look at that with a microscope?
Yeah. I mean, the mythological Hydra is a human creation.
Exactly.
It changes every time you tell it.
Exactly.
You can't, so many of these problems, you can't just apply physics and see, you can't just look at it from a fluid dynamics standpoint and try and figure it out. maybe that can be helpful in some cases in figuring out a part of the problem.
Yeah.
If it's applicable, but probably not. Number nine, solutions to wicked problems are usually one-shot efforts that minimize trial and error efforts. Every implemented solution has consequences that cannot be undone. And this is where we get to, the fact that every time you try and solve the wicked problem, you change the problem.
Right.
And now you have a slightly different problem to have to deal with.
Yeah, it's not like a mathematical equation where you like, you figure out what X is, right? Like every time in these situations, if you figure out what X is, then like it changes what the definition of all the other numbers are in the original equation.
It's kind of like this Rubik's Cube that is on the table in the podcast chamber where we're recording right now. It's like if I'm trying to solve this thing, but every time I move it, I cannot move it back to where it was.
Yeah.
And I'm just lost every time because each time I try to solve it, it is a new problem that I never get a second shot at solving the same problem.
The Rubik's Cube's a great metaphor for wicked problems. That would be interesting.
Except it can be solved.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe the lament configuration is a better example.
Okay. Every wicked problem is unique. This is number 10. There is no precedent. So what this means is essentially that you can't look back to any previous wicked problem that you've tried to make better as like a template to say, okay, well, let's try the same thing that we tried with that here and see if it works, because they're so totally unique that there's no model to work from.
And number 11, this is an interesting one. Designers attempting to address a wicked problem must be fully responsible for their actions.
Yeah. So this one, I don't know that I had trouble with it as much as just that, like, you know, it's essentially a mission statement by the authors here saying like, okay, so if you're going to approach this from a design policy standpoint, you have to own it.
Yeah. And certainly, I mean, this seems like it is, or at least certainly should be, just part of the, you know, any political attempt or military attempt or what have you to tackle any kind of, socioeconomic wicked problem is that, yeah, anything you do, you should be held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
as we often see that accountability doesn't always, spread to everyone in these scenarios.
It's also important to note here, like, we can say, though, that not all hard to solve problems are wicked, only those that have an indeterminate scope and scale. So let's go back to the Rubik's Cube, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard to solve problem, but it's not wicked.
Yeah. Well, you have a clear objective, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you solve this thing? Well, you get, I'll know it's solved when I have all the same colors on the same side.
Exactly.
So like wicked problems, you don't know at what point do you know it's solved. And there's also no instant feedback because the effects of trying to implement changes, say, you know, in society, you're not going to get instant feedback. You're going to get feedback rolling in waves over years, decades to come.
Like we were just mentioning with the war on drugs thing.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier for us now. 30 plus years later to say, oh, that seems like a silly approach, or at least the branding approach to it. I don't want to criticize the methodology necessarily.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will discuss macro wicked problems, wicked problems in science, and micro wicked problems. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
LASIK. LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com. One place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
All right, we're back.
So we've been talking about wicked problems and how it's a framework that we can sort of apply almost to anything, right? Like, as I was saying before, I had a friend who was like, well, you could talk about the human body as being a wicked problem. Mm-hmm. But let's take a look at sort of the definition that it was originally assigned for and what I'm calling, for the purposes of this episode, macro wicked problems, which are the things, the best example I can think of to tie this to is the current political campaign, right? So, and maybe you're not American, but you're probably familiar with all the zaniness that's going on in our political process right now. Or maybe wherever you're from, I can't imagine that politics are all that much different. It's the same friend who mentioned the human body thing had recently traveled to Ghana. And he was like, yeah, you know, over there, there was an election cycle in process while I was visiting there. And it was the same as it is here. It's just on a different level.
Yeah.
So what we're talking about here are the stances of where these, you know, these various politicians think that they have the one single answer to solve a problem that society is basically, you know, arguing over, right? The budget and economy, civil rights, rights of corporations, crime, drugs. We've mentioned those already. Education, how we use energy and oil, the environment, foreign policy, free trade, how we reform our government. That one alone, wow, what a tangled mess that would be.
Yeah, I mean, did you mention climate change in that list?
Climate change is at the end here, okay. Yeah.
That's a big one, because, I mean, that one fits all the definitions that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Multiple stakeholders. Yeah, I mean, that one fits most of the criteria we've been discussing, especially multiple stakeholders, different views on what success means and what the root cause is and what the problem is to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Gun control, same thing, right? It's such a complex issue. It's not just, you know, it's always interesting to try to bring it down to a personal level. But, you know, like, I have friends who own guns and love their guns and are very, very much want to keep their guns and are against gun control. And it's not, for them, it's not like a connected to crime at all, right? They don't see that. But then there's the wicked problem of the connections between gun control and crime and drugs and education. You see how they all kind of span together.
Oh yeah. I mean, on the gun control issue, we see it time and time again. Like the issue comes up and, you know, one side says, oh, well, it's not a gun issue. It's a mental health issue. Other side says, well, if you take all the guns away, you're still not, people are still going to kill each other. I mean, it goes back and forth with people, people are arguing, and the one thing that's becoming clear is that we don't even have a full grasp. Like, the problem itself is amorphous and shapeless. And all that these different voices are doing is trying to give shape to the problem.
Yeah, exactly. When you can't.
Yeah.
So a couple of really quick other ones, right, that you're going to be hearing about, or you're probably currently hearing about: Homeland Security, immigration. That's a big one. Jobs, Social Security, tax reform, technology. This kept coming back to me because we work in the digital media industry, and it changes so quickly that it's interesting to see how both policymakers and business people try to adapt with it. And it's impossible to sort of predict the wave of how it's going to progress, right? And then there's, of course, the good old war and poverty ones. So, yeah, these are all huge issues that affect all of us. And I think, like, based on the definition that we set up for you before the break, you can see how these are all wicked problems.
All right. We've already discussed, like, the problem of trying to apply science to wicked problems, that it's not an A plus B equals C scenario. It's right. Not like saying, oh, how do we get people to the moon? That's a hard problem to solve. We solved it,
but
though, because we knew what the problem was, and we knew what the destination was, and we knew how to know that we had succeeded.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And so this is actually the impetus for us talking about wicked problems here today, is there was a great article earlier in the week that came out from the Bangor Daily News, and it was written by a woman named Linda Silka, and she is a social and community psychologist at the University of Maine. And basically, she was addressing how Maine as a state is coming together and trying to approach their wicked problems in a different way, using science, basically. And she says, and this is the key here. This is why I thought this really connected well to our show. She argues, look, there's this popular culture image of science where there's a lab coated researcher and they prove a brilliant idea. And, they've solved it, right? They've solved a problem, or they've given humanity more knowledge about a thing. The Hydra, right? When we discussed the actual Hydra and its anatomy in the previous episode, the way that we talked about it, I had that in my head. And I'm imagining that some of our listeners did too, of people in lab coats looking at Hydras under microscopes and going, aha, we solved it, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we encounter this occasionally with listeners and readers for Stuff to Blow Your Mind, because there's that vision, but science also involves getting it wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Getting it wrong a lot. Like, that's how we help define what we know and what direction the research is going, by making mistakes. Mistakes that you can't necessarily make in tackling a wicked problem.
Yeah. I mean, so, like, for some of the things that we work on here at How Stuff Works, this comes up again and again, where we're tasked with answering how X works, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't always an answer. Very often, especially like when Joe and I are writing for our general science video show, Brain Stuff, the answer is, well, science doesn't know yet, but here's what we do know, right?
Right.
And I can't tell you how many times we've seen answers in the comments on social media or YouTube or something where people are like, well, why did you even bother to make this? because science doesn't have the answer. And I think, well, the importance is, like, well, when we cover what we do know, then we're able to sort of approach it differently, right?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of gets down into that area too of, this is something science doesn't know, but here are some theories as to how it might work. That's just how we feel our way out.
That's, yeah,
how we,
exactly,
figure out
that's
the potential,
how we
answer
move
is
forward.
Yeah.
So Silka's argument is that this lab-coded research myth is becoming outdated, and that we need to make efforts to ensure that research can help solve the societal challenges we have, like wicked problems, like all the things that we were just defining. But she's looking at it very much from a Maine perspective, because she's working at the University of Maine. So she says, in order to solve these, science needs to be approached in a more complex way. There needs to be interaction between scientists, decision makers, and citizens. And you may have heard about this discussed elsewhere. Some people label it as citizen science. I know a couple years ago, I went to South by Southwest, and that was like the big term that was being thrown around. A lot of people were creating apps that allowed everyone everybody to be a citizen scientist and to go out and gather data with their phones by like taking pictures, and then it would upload to a particular scientist's laboratory.
Yeah, various efforts to say everybody everybody take pictures of whale sharks that you encounter and
Put
into a database. Everyone use a screensaver that enables SETI to search for intelligent life.
Yeah, the library that I used to work at was part of the World Community Grid that contributed basically whenever the computers were in sleep mode, they were contributing their processing power toward solving scientific problems.
Yeah.
So her argument is essentially that all of us need to know about the issues and all of us need to be involved because we all have important roles to play. And she says, let's move away from what is called the loading dock approach to science. And the metaphor for that loading dock approach to science goes like this. You got a scientist and they're basically acting like a factory that produces widgets, right? And they're not producing widgets for any particular person. Then they just put those widgets on the loading dock and they wait for somebody to come along and go, oh, that's something I have a use for, and take it away, right? And I see this, you know, having worked in academia previously, of course, like the way that that system is set up, it's not always necessarily working in conjunction to solve a problem. More often it's kind of like, I need to get published so that I can get
published or die.
Right. So instead of the loading dock procedure, she says we should create a product that is useful to people who actually need it. So science should try to work together to figure out the poor and the hungry issues that we've been talking about, or something that doesn't require people to necessarily have full access to the set of complications that are involved in scientific research. Essentially, I think what they mean by that is like you don't have to have a PhD, right? We already have really scarce science resources, as we know from all the stuff that we cover for the show and for the other stuff that we work on here. How do we focus our solutions for the right kind of stakeholders? Well, in Maine, she says researchers are trying to tackle this problem differently, and specifically so that the way that they address sustainability. So they're bringing together shellfish harvesters with their policymakers and biologists and economists to all discuss the issues surrounding what I would assume is, you know, farming shellfish for food industry. Another example she gave was solving the decline in Maine's blueberry crops, which they see as also being connected to the collapse of their pollinator bee population. Now, I don't know how many times in different forms or shows here at How Stuff Works we've talked about colony collapse disorder. It's something that's on a lot of people's radar. But this is an interesting way to approach it, that it's not just, okay, that's a science issue we need to solve, but also, hey, we've got these blueberries over here that are important to our economy. What does that mean for this? You know, and then ultimately she says there's also scientists who are going to argue against this. So be prepared for a backlash. And there's lots of scientists who will claim that anyone who doesn't have formal training, they won't do any good research, right? They're not going to be capable of contributing to the discipline. It's what in academia is often referred to as the siloing effect, right? Where everybody puts themselves in little silos and they sort of have their fiefdoms that they want to fight over control over.
Well, in Maine, this is exactly how the Arrowhead facility opened up that rift into the Todesh darkness.
Exactly. You know? It's, you know what? Like, the mist would not have happened if we just approached things as a wicked problem.
I know.
All those people in that grocery store, man.
Yeah. It was a tough time.
You know what? That's a good segue for us to bring it down. We've been up in the outer space of Todesh darkness, talking about the macro version of this, talking about the science version of it. Let's bring it down to the micro level, right? We've all worked for organizations, presumably, right? In our current society, that's how we can afford the devices that we have to listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, even if you don't have to work for an organization, you're probably having to come in contact with organizations, you know?
Yeah,
if you're that lone hitman, you still have to work for the mafia.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing Watson X Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with Watson X Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So what we found when we were looking at the wicked problem thing is, it's being applied in the science aspect up in Maine. But by and large, almost all the research that was showing up for me was management stuff or business review type magazines. And the big one that I looked to was a piece by John Camillus that was in the Harvard Business Review in 2008. And basically, he studied strategic planning at 22 different companies. Then he looked in depth at 7 of them, and he finally zoned in specifically on DuPont Pharmaceuticals, which has come up on the show before. I can't remember off the top of my head. Was it Alexander Shulgin who worked for DuPont? It was somebody like that.
If it wasn't, I think it was Shulgin.
It might have been Shulgin.
It wasn't Lilly.
No, right. So he zoned in on DuPont to kind of see how that company drew up its strategies to deal with uncertainty. And he used all of these to come up with ways to talk about taming problems within the workplace, the ones that can't be solved, the wicked problems. So, Camillus basically makes the same argument that those guys made back in the early 70s, but in terms of companies, right? So he says companies are faced with constant wicked problems in their increasingly complex environment. So you're looking at changing the way that we look at strategic planning processes, which are very traditional. They don't address wicked problems in any way. So, in fact, the actual processes that are used to approach the problems may in fact be wicked problems themselves.
Right. Every time you change the structure of the business, potentially new wicked problem arises.
Yeah. I'm thinking of like every time like a company goes through a reorganization, right? Or a restructuring.
Or pivots.
Pivoting, which is something we hear about quite often. Big surprise, this piece was written 8 years ago, and it doesn't seem like policymakers and companies have really acknowledged it yet. I've worked here for 3 years. I've worked in the public sector, in academia, and in libraries. I used to work for a publishing company before this, and then long ago I was a graphic designer working in a sort of a direct marketing world, and I didn't see at any of those businesses a sort of recognition of the like organizational principle of the wicked problem. And I don't know, maybe they're out there. I'd love to hear it. If some of you out there listening work for a company that thinks about, running the company in such a way, let us know, because it sounds like it would be, I don't know, sort of heavenly place to work at.
Well, you know, one of the issues is that I feel like a lot of workplaces, and I'm speaking to my history with various employers over the years.
Yeah.
Is that, it's one thing to have a meeting about a problem, to try and define that problem. And in a way, that's good.
Yeah.
Like, that's how you should approach wicked problems, is to not just throw out solutions willy-nilly and see what happens. You should discuss it. You should try and figure out what are some of the root issues here. What are the different viewpoints? But a lot of times in a corporate environment, like, that's all that gets done. Like, mm-hmm. You have those meetings, the results are typed up, and the wicked problem summary winds up on somebody's desk. Maybe there are some recommended solutions. Maybe some of those get implemented. Maybe the safer ones get implemented. But does anything ultimately change? Maybe not.
Yeah, that's actually interesting, because Camillus, you know, one of his recommendations is essentially, right at the top, he says, well, you got to involve your stakeholders and document everybody's opinions, and then make sure that everybody's communicating about what those opinions are. And that's mm-hmm. what you just described, but you're right. In a lot of situations, it just kind of stops there.
Yeah.
Right? Like there isn't the action part that comes after it. And he actually came up with his own five symptoms based off of all these other people came up with. And they're fairly similar. You know, we get the same thing with there's many stakeholders. They all have different values and different priorities. Of course, you see that in the workplace, right? Like, some managers of some departments have their own values and priorities, while another manager in another tier above them and to the side of them has a different set of priorities. And it's not necessarily being communicated clearly.
Yeah. Or in the worst situations, you're one of those employees who finds yourself with two or more bosses.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
trying to figure out,
yeah.
well, who am I listening to? What is the priority?
And just like the larger macro problems, you know, they've got complex, tangled roots. Their problem, it's difficult to come to grips with. And every time you try to approach it, it changes. I'm thinking I'm thinking of previous workplaces I've been at where like there's been a problem employee, right? And mm-hmm. it's just like a person that everybody knows is a problem. And you go, well, the simple solution is just fire that person. But like in certain atmospheres, you can't just do that, right? Because there's repercussions to that as well that subsequently tangle and lead to other problems too.
Yeah.
I have unfortunately seen that in many workplaces. Again, they have no precedent. There's nothing to indicate what the right answer is, right? There's no, like, I love how we all think of HR, human resources, as being like, oh, well, they've got the answer, right? Like, there's a handbook. They go to school for that. So clearly there's got to be a way to approach this in a particular way that has the answer, but I don't necessarily know that that's true.
Yeah, I mean, you get the sense that they have a system, they may have a guide, they may have a way to discuss a problem that arises, but ultimately we've all heard of situations with people we know where the HR solution is not the best solution.
Yeah, certainly, yeah. And it's interesting too, because like my wife has worked at all different kinds of companies as well too. I feel like between the two of us over the last 15 years, we've had like this very a broad spectrum of types of places to work at. And yet, like, we see the same problems at all of them, you know?
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it comes down to what was the famous Reagan quote about government, government isn't the solution to the problems. Government is the problem.
Oh,
which is, you know, I think going a bit too far, but it does tie in to the basic idea that the body that tries to fix a wicked problem, be it, you know, a large sweeping macro problem or a micro problem, the body that tries to fix something almost inevitably messes it up or messes it up for some people.
Yeah, it's like it's almost like you have to figure out like, okay, they're going to mess this up, but is the mess that's going to be left afterwards better than the mess that we have now?
Yeah, what is my relationship to the mess going to be?
Right.
Like I know it's going to be messy, but can I live with the mess?
So, let's quickly go through Camillus's solutions, which are beyond just like what you described, which is the sort of, yeah, everybody sit around and talk about a thing. Mm-hmm. We'll write it down and we'll put it in a document somewhere and file it away. Does this sound familiar for anybody out there? Define what your corporate identity is, right? What are the company's values? What is it competent at? And what are its aspirations? I can't tell you how many places I've worked for that, that those aren't clear to all the employees. And yet, like, it seems like something that should just be relatively simple, right? Even like when we see like fictional versions of companies, I'm thinking of what's the evil company in RoboCop?
Omni.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that's a perfect example. Like the people who worked there seemed to pretty much have an idea of what its values were, what they were good at building killer robots and what its aspirations were, which was basically take over the city of Detroit. Right. But you find in a lot of situations that there's like a vague, sort of anxiety inducing, amorphousness to what the company you work for is doing, right?
Yeah. I mean, meanwhile, you go to like your average kindergarten class and generally the rules are on the wall. You know?
Yeah, right. So. Exactly. That would be great if we had that like on the refrigerator or something at all different corporations.
Yeah.
Just like here's what it is.
Yeah. Have the public.
It's written in crayon. There's also, of course, like what Robert was mentioning earlier, you got to take action on things. And this connects to what we were talking about with the rapid prototyping. So instead of thinking through every option that's available before choosing a single one, they recommend, well, Camillus does in particular, experimenting with multiple strategies that seem like they're feasible and launch innovative pilot programs. And this is interesting to me because this is something that actually at How Stuff Works we've heard a lot in the last, I'd say, 2 years maybe, which is don't be afraid to fail, right? And there's at first I had trouble struggling with that. And now I sort of see, oh, okay. So this is that approach that, I don't know that rapid prototyping is the right term.
The way I've often heard it, described is the whole, fail quickly and
yeah.
fail often, you know?
Yeah.
Which is
try a bunch of different things.
Which is, you know, sort of A/B testing.
That's okay.
Right?
Then we know not to do that one approach.
Yeah. Yeah. Like generally A/B testing is a great way to do this. You just roll it out for some people and you show them A, you show them B, you figure out what works and you go with that and you do this in, you know, without having to, invest much more time and money.
Yeah.
In testing the product.
And you bring it back to the macro level for a second here and you go, oh wow, like there's no way that governments can act this way, right? Because if they're just like, well, we'll just try 20 different things and if 19 of them fail, at least we'll have found one thing that works. There's plenty of people out there who go, well, what about all my tax dollars that were just spent on the 19 things that didn't work, right?
Yeah.
So there's inherently a wicked problem there as well.
Well, and a lot of businesses are maybe have a lot more in common with dictatorships,
yeah.
as opposed to a democratic republic. So, you know, it's a little more complicated on the macro level. I think.
Well, spinning off your dictatorship metaphor, it's kind of interesting because dictators don't necessarily have this one particular communication orientation that Camillus recommends, and I like this. It really stems out of the basic necessity of all kinds of human communication, and it is to adopt what's called a feed-forward orientation. So when you're trying to solve problems, don't just use feedback for communicating with your organization about what the problems are and how to tame them, because feedback relies solely on the past and what happened, while wicked problems all arise out of an unclear future, right? So remember that indeterminable scope that they have. So you really need to envision that future that's unclear and try to envision what you'd like it to be. So this gets back to the aspirations of who you're working for. And then communicate what that organization wants its future to look like to everybody involved in the organization.
You know, it's interesting because some of these ideas regarding the corporate environment, they have spilled over into sort of family management scenarios. There, for instance, in my family, my wife and my son, we try and have a weekly meeting.
Oh yeah.
And at the weekly meeting, everybody has to discuss
what worked during the week, what didn't work during the week, what they would like to change in the coming week.
Oh, that's
smart. Well as like what we would like to eat in the coming week, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. But that approach is based on some of the principles that have been bouncing around, in the corporate world, for the past 10 years or so.
Yeah, that is an interesting approach. What we're talking about here is just open communication, which surprisingly, you know, for human beings, which like one of our greatest assets is our ability to communicate with one another, we're not so good at doing it in these kind of situations where we're tackling these real world big problems.
Yeah, I mean, we did a workbook for it where we even had to come up with our own essentially our corporate identity for our family. Like what's our motto? What are our values?
I bet Bastion had a giraffe in there somewhere.
He was not super helpful in the crafting of the of this particular document.
But that sounds like good advice for any, you know, family unit, you know.
So, you know, who are we? What are we trying to do here?
Yeah, what's
this little family experiment? You know, let's get out of the moment to moment thing and just think a little broader.
Yeah, I like that. That's cool. Well, it sounds like that you can take that and you can extrapolate it outwards and apply it on the work level. You can apply it on the science level, and then you can apply it on the sort of macro scale level that we've been talking about. So that really gets at the gist of Wicked Problems. We weren't able to, I mean, you know, obviously it's much denser than what we talked about today. And I feel like this is maybe a little denser than most Stuff to Blow Your Mind episodes are. But, you know, we at least covered the surface of this is what they are. This is how they apply to the real world that we exist in and science.
Yeah. And I have no doubt that we will refer back to Wicked Problems in the future as we tackle other topics, be they, you know, ultimately scientific or more likely cultural.
So those of you out there listening, let us know. I'm really curious. I'm always curious to see what our audience has to say about our episodes. But in this instance in particular, I'd like to see what you think about the theory of Wicked Problems, how it's applicable in your life, or how you could see it being applicable maybe on a larger scale. Or those of you out there, we know a lot of people who listen to the show are graduate students or actual scientists working in laboratories, how it affects the work that you're doing.
Yeah, indeed. And then how do you personally tackle wicked problems? How do you think about them? Because there are wicked problems that exist, you know, within a country. There are wicked problems that exist within a family. How do you dance around those and define them?
So, usual places to reach out to us and let us know your thoughts on these things. We've got Facebook, we're on Twitter, we are on Tumblr, we're even on Instagram now. We're going to start posting to that soon, and you can start seeing pictures of things that we're taking and of us, and probably images, I would assume, of the podcast episodes that we're distributing as well.
Yeah, we're blow the mind on there. I think currently there's just one picture of me with a third eye, and that's it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's a good place to start.
Yeah.
And then, of course, how else could they reach out to us to discuss their wicked problems?
Oh, just get in touch with us the old-fashioned way. Email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.